everyone, and welcome back to another episode of World of Sharks, a podcast all about sharks, rays, and their underwater habitat, brought to you by the Save Our Seas Foundation. I'm Isla, a scientist and science communicator for the Save Our Seas Foundation, and every episode I sit down with experts in shark science, conservation, education, and storytelling to take you on a deep dive into a different part of the wonderful world of sharks. This week, we are taking a trip to Indonesia to meet interdisciplinary researcher Dr. Holly Booth. Holly works at the intersection of conservation and social justice, which means her research works towards finding solutions that not only protect sharks, but also ensure that the people whose livelihoods depend on them are not negatively impacted. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations estimate that small-scale fisheries account for at least 40% of the global fish catch and support the livelihoods of nearly 500 million people. As we'll discuss in this episode, people fish for a number of different reasons, and in some of the poorest nations around the world, people not only depend on sharks as a source of income, but also to feed and support their families. So solving the problem of overfishing isn't as easy as simply banning fisheries. It requires understanding all of these nuances, all of the factors that are driving shark fishing, to really get to the bottom of why people fish sharks and include their views and needs in whatever solutions that we come up with. Holly has worked extensively with small-scale fisheries in Indonesia, one of the world's largest shark fishing nations with a population largely dependent on coastal livelihoods. For her PhD, Holly researched the socioeconomic drivers of shark fishing and gained an understanding of people's perspectives of certain species, especially those that were being caught and sold as bycatch. In doing so, she has been able to develop strategies to encourage fishers to release the sharks rather than trade them. And through her Save Our Seas-funded project, Solutions for Shark Fisheries in a Surfer's Paradise, Holly has come up with an innovative way to fund such schemes, utilising Indonesia's thriving tourism industry. We talk about all this and more in this episode, discussing how important it is to factor in the social and economic side of conservation, and why it matters who benefits and who bears the cost of conservation. We also talk about the challenges and the joys of working with people and how this can result in positive outcomes for sharks. It's a really thought-provoking episode, and Holly is such a brilliant guest. She's done so much important work building relationships and trust with fisheries and many other stakeholders, along with her fantastic team in Indonesia. If you'd like to follow along with Holly's work, we will leave links in the show notes as to how you can do that, so please do go and check that out. But for now, grab your surfboard and let's dive in to our episode. Hello, Holly Booth, and welcome to the World of Sharks podcast. We got there eventually.
Thanks, Isla. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the podcast. We really, really do appreciate it. And we're going to be talking all about your fascinating research in Indonesia, all the work that you do with small-scale fisheries and tourism and incentives for shark conservation, all of that fascinating stuff. But before we dive into that, we'd like to get to know you a little better. We like to start and end the podcast with the same question for every single guest. And I've learned after doing about 55 episodes of this podcast that it's a very difficult question, and I apologize in advance for that. But it is, do you have an experience with the ocean that stands out for you as particularly memorable or special?
Yeah, so I think it's quite difficult to pick just one answer, because I definitely have lots of very memorable experiences with the ocean, especially because I love scuba diving and I also love to surf. So I think obviously probably catching my first ever wave would be a really memorable one. But in terms of keeping it on brand for the podcast, probably either the first time I ever saw live sharks while scuba diving was definitely absolutely incredible. And I've also had a couple of amazing experiences of scuba diving with manta rays when it's just been kind of crazy currents. Manta rays swimming all around you, coming super close, kind of swooping and diving and literally coming out of the water like squealing because it was just so amazing.
I do love it when that happens and you have this kind of incredible experience under the water and you can hear your buddy screaming down the regulator or something like that and see all the bubbles and stuff. It's so exciting. Exactly. But your career has been very diverse. You know, you've worked in multiple countries, you've worked across lots of species. So when did sharks kind of first come into your life? Was that kind of when you saw them for the first time underwater, like you're talking about then?
So I've always just loved wildlife and nature of kind of all varieties. I know some people that work in shark conservation kind of started from when they were a kid, and they just sharks are their favorite animal, and they loved sharks, and they knew that that's what they wanted to do. Whereas I kind of loved all wildlife and was never necessarily focused on one particular species. I actually first started working specifically on shark and ray conservation during my master's project. My master's research was focused specifically on illegal manta ray trade. And I'd done a bunch of work in the past to do with wildlife trade. And I was also quite interested in impact assessment and methods for trying to figure out whether conservation is successful or not. And there was a project working with the Wildlife Conservation Society that was about trying to figure out that there's been a new law to protect manta rays in Indonesia. And the project was to try to figure out whether or not it was successful. And so Indonesia sounded really cool. It was impact assessment, it was wildlife trade, and then it was manta rays. And so manta rays were then kind of like my gateway animal into becoming a shark and ray person. So after that project, I ended up working as a technical advisor for the Wildlife Conservation Society for several years in Indonesia, which then eventually led on to my PhD. And since then, I mean, I've been in Indonesia for about 8 years now. So
Wow.
yeah, the rest is history.
Yeah, what an incredible master's project to have done.
It was good. It was fun. It was interesting. It was hard as well, because it's one of these things where, you know, you're trying to get data to analyze, but because it's an illegal behavior, it's like inherently difficult to get reliable data on what's going on. But no, it was fun and challenging, and I got to come to Indonesia, and yeah, it was great.
And I mean, your work now is interdisciplinary, right? So you're combining methodologies from both the biological and the social sciences and sort of working with humans, which, as we know, is an immense challenge. As you've just said, sometimes when we're working in things like the illegal trade, people don't necessarily want to talk about that. You know, it's quite a worrying thing for them to open up about, and it can be quite difficult to get data. But when did you know, you talk a lot about making sure that solutions are not just good ecologically, but also that they are equitable and that they are also socially just. And I was interested, you know, when did you first kind of become interested in that more human side of conservation, and why do you think it's so important to shark conservation?
Yeah, great question. So, well, I studied natural sciences as an undergraduate, but I was also really interested in sort of international development, poverty alleviation, education, social justice. And I did a couple of volunteer projects over the summers when I was still undergrad on, education related things or working with communities in Nepal and in Kenya. And at that point, I kind of wished I'd focused a little bit more on kind of like social sciences or development economics, or because I was actually more interested in going into a more development or human related field. But I always absolutely loved nature and wildlife and the sciences as well. And then when I was in, I think, the final year of my undergraduate, I'd taken a zoology module. And within that module, we started learning about conservation biology. And I remember thinking that it wasn't really science. I remember being like, this isn't very scientific. It seems to be more like geography, or it's just more about people. And at some point, I remember revising for my final year exams, I had this like epiphany moment where I was like, oh my God, conservation is the thing where my two interests and passions actually come together. It's like to do with nature and wildlife, but it's also about, changing human behavior and kind of the fundamental relationship between people and nature, basically. And so I was like, this is the thing, conservation is the thing that I want to do. And so I've just kind of always been inherently interested in, I guess, interactions between people and nature and trade-offs between, you know, economic development and biodiversity conservation, and trade-offs between human well-being and biodiversity conservation, because they're always there ultimately. I mean, like, human activities and actions are what degrades nature, but at the same time, you know, we need to eat in order to thrive. And so I've just always been fascinated in kind of how you manage those two, which is actually in many ways why I ended up getting so interested in shark and ray conservation. Because, I mean, I like complex problems, and I like thinking about things at the interface between, yeah, human well-being and conservation. And after spending time in Indonesia, I just realized that in many ways, shark conservation epitomized these challenges, especially in small-scale fisheries, where you've got people who are, you know, very dependent on fisheries, and in some cases, dependent on endangered species for their food and income. And obviously, we want to get fewer dead sharks in fisheries. That's the kind of goal of shark conservation, but it is ultimately at odds with people's sort of short-term livelihood objectives. So it's like, how do we tackle this challenge?
Yeah, it was so funny hearing you talk about your journey into the more kind of social side of things there, because we have a lot of similarities in sort of our journeys. I mean, I started out as a zoologist, and I was actually working on minke whales, which is like a small species of whale up here. And I kind of fell into the social side of things just as a complete, almost like a happy accident, I would say. And I think for the first couple of years of my PhD, I was still like, no, I am, you know, I'm an ecologist, I'm a zoologist, I'm just happening to work on humans. And then now I am probably, I would say, a fully fledged social scientist. So, you know, it's quite funny.
No, it's funny. I mean, people still sometimes refer to me as like a marine biologist or a marine ecologist. And I'm like, I don't really know if that's who I am. Or like, they ask me questions about random fish and random sharks, and I'll be like, do you know, you know, really specific kind of biological questions. And I'm like, this is not really my area of expertise. I'm sorry. I know that you think that I'm a marine biologist, but actually I spend most of my time like talking to people or, you know, looking at dead sharks in fish markets more than actually kind of being in the water.
And before we get deeper into your research, I think it's really important to sort of touch on the nuances of fishing, because you mentioned there, you know, small scale fisheries. We're going to be talking about kind of small scale, more artisanal fisheries. But I think what we tend to do is lump all types of fishing together, you know, when we just talk about fishing, when in reality, there's lots of different scales and there's lots of different methods. And I wondered if you could just talk us through, you know, not in great detail, but kind of give us an overview of some of those differences. So, you know, what are you talking about when you talk about small scale artisanal? But then we've also got, you know, the industrial side of things as well.
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And I think often, you know, when you ask people about shark conservation and the threats facing sharks, people typically say, oh, it's because of the fin trade, and just think there's kind of one problem and one solution. However, you know, it's way more complicated than that. And my experience shows that there are many different drivers for catching sharks. And in some instances, it is profit motivation because of the fin trade, but it can also be for food. It can also be for cultural reasons. It can also be because of poverty, because people basically have no other better way of making their living. And it can also be because people use nets and lines to catch other fish, and the sharks hang out where the other fish hang out. And so the sharks end up getting caught as well. And in some cases, it's kind of a mixture of all of those things, which is what makes it even more complicated. And so, yeah, I guess then in terms of the different types of fisheries, I mean, as I mentioned, I primarily work on small-scale fisheries in Indonesia. It can be very difficult to define exactly what the difference is between a small-scale fishery and an industrial fishery, and sometimes it depends on different countries' legislation and where the boats are allowed to operate. But we're typically talking about pretty small boats with 1 to 5 maximum people on the boat. They normally don't go too far offshore, typically kind of one-day fishing trips, sometimes 3-day fishing trips. Some of these boats, despite the fact that they're very small, do spend weeks out at sea, which can also be pretty dangerous. The thing is that every time I try to think of a way to define it, there's always kind of an exception. So typically the fisheries that I work in have kind of mixed markets. So a lot of the catch might be used for local consumption, but then some of the catch will be used for domestic consumption. So it might be sent elsewhere within Indonesia, but then certain high value commodities might also be sent for export. So to give you an example, some of the small scale fisheries that I have been working in Aceh, they use gillnets to go and catch sort of various reef and demersal fish, but they're fishing in habitat of some critically endangered sharks and rays. So they're also catching sharks and rays. Most of the fish and the meat from the sharks and rays that they catch is used for local or domestic consumption. However, if they happen to catch a big wedge fish that's got a big fin that is valuable for the fin trade, that fin will get cut off and will be sent off into a sort of a different supply chain. So it all gets very complicated. And, you know, it would be nice to be able to say small scale fisheries and just these tiny vessels and they only catch fish for local consumption. But my experience tells me that it often isn't the case. There's often kind of a mixture of different local level and international level drivers involved in those fisheries. But obviously, you know, the clearest distinction is that the vessels are typically very small. Mm-hmm. The technology that they're using is typically basic and it's mostly sort of manual using their hands. Whereas in industrial fisheries, you know, you've got enormous vessels crewed by large amounts of people. They've typically got mechanized gears. And normally the catch from those vessels goes into kind of huge international supply chains for multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. And the vessels might be out at sea for weeks and weeks on end. So you've kind of got, I think all things typically exist on a spectrum.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one end of the small scale fishery, you've got your like one man, small boat, artisanal fishing. And then at the other end, you've got your kind of mega industrial vessel that's out at sea for months on end.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not, as you said, it's never quite as black and white as that. And there's lots of complexity sort of even within these fisheries that it's, you know, it takes years to kind of wrap your head around and understand. And that's what you've really been doing in Indonesia. And a great example of that complexity in your work is with bycatch, because you found that, we used that word spectrum earlier, you found that there's also a spectrum with bycatch and how fishers perceive the different species, you know, that they catch incidentally. Can you sort of tell us a little bit more about this?
Yes. So yeah, again, bycatch is one of these terms that is often used, but is actually quite complicated. And one of the things that I found here in Indonesia is we often have these kind of multi-species, multi-gear fisheries, where fishers might have a kind of primary target that is the most valuable, that's the main thing they're going out to catch. But if they catch other stuff, then it's all useful and valuable and used. There is nothing that necessarily goes to waste. And I found in these kinds of fisheries, when I asked fishers, you know, why do you catch sharks and rays? Trying to dig down into the kind of underlying social and economic drivers, they'll say, oh, it's just bycatch. And that was kind of used as almost like an excuse, or it would like shut the conversation down and it wasn't possible to like go any deeper. And so I wanted to try and add a little bit more nuance to this term bycatch. And essentially the idea that, again, bycatch kind of exists on a spectrum. On the one end of the spectrum, you have more like genuine bycatch that might be sharks and rays or other species that the fishers genuinely don't want. So like for some reason, if they catch it, it represents a cost or an opportunity cost to the fishers. Maybe it might break their net, or it might take up space in the net or in the holds that they could otherwise fill with more valuable species. And it's actually just like a technical issue that sometimes these species are captured. And if we can come up with some kind of, you know, technical fix so that we can actually help fishers to not catch these species anymore, then it's actually kind of a win-win for everybody, because it solves a problem for the fishers and it solves a problem for conservationists. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you have what I prefer to call kind of valuable secondary catch or cheeky bonus catch, And I think this is true in most small scale fisheries in Indonesia and in lots of places, where essentially all fish have some kind of either subsistence or economic value. And so it might not be the main fish that fishers want to catch, or the most valuable fish that fishers want to catch. But if they do catch it, then great. Like, they can keep it, they can eat it, they can sell it, and it's kind of part of their overall livelihood strategy.
Yeah, so there's that kind of complexity again. And I mean, I work a lot with our vision of small-scale fishers here in Scotland, and the context is completely different. So, you know, again, a lot of the species that they catch as bycatch, they actually can't, there isn't a market for them, they can't sell them on the market. So then we have more of those sort of quote unquote, I don't want to use the word pest species, but that's how the fishermen describe them. So there is that very real complexity there that makes it very difficult to find solutions. There is no one size fits all solution, unfortunately. You also discussed there that you looked into some of the more socioeconomic drivers of shark fishing and barriers to shark conservation and solutions to the problem of overfishing. And I wondered if you could tell us, you know, a little bit about what some of those barriers are. I know we just talked there about bycatch and kind of how that can be on a spectrum. And I suppose understanding that is part of a way to find solutions to shark conservation.
Yeah, exactly. And so I guess my research really was initially focused on actually trying to really understand, you know, what are these underlying social and economic issues in order to find solutions. I mean, essentially, you know, my take is that if you don't understand what drives people and what drives their decisions and behaviors, then you can't come up with kind of meaningful solutions that are going to work in the long term. So, you know, one of the kind of first steps was about trying to sort of like diagnose these different constraints. And essentially, one of the biggest issues that I found was that, especially when we're talking about kind of small-scale mixed species tropical fisheries, fishers who are going out on daily fishing trips, and they're using the money to cover their families' daily food and subsistence needs, to pay for their kids to go to school. We're not talking about wealthy people, and, you know, they don't have huge amounts of savings or kind of like buffer money. It really is just like a cash economy. And so when they go out fishing, everything that they catch is important as part of their overall livelihood strategy. And so if through conservation, we ask fishers to reduce their catches of certain species, or to stop catching certain species, or to release certain species, or to stop fishing in certain areas, that ultimately represents some kind of cost to the fishers. And so the biggest barrier in lots of these situations is that if we want to get fishers to comply, we need to figure out some way of compensating for these costs. And we also need to think about the ethics of conservation. I mean, is it actually right and just that we ask some of the world's poorest people to bear the majority of the costs of conservation, especially in the context of, and as we were talking about in terms of, you know, industrial fisheries, there are wealthy people and huge multinational corporations that have enormous negative impact on the environment and typically don't bear any of the costs. So on one level, it's about kind of changing human behavior and getting people to comply with conservation actions. And then on the other hand, it's also making sure that we do conservation in a way that is socially just. I mean, based on my experiences, those kinds of economic barriers are some of the biggest. In some instances as well, you also have sort of social barriers. So sometimes people have cultural reasons why they might catch certain species. It might be considered kind of really cool, or you have sort of rock star status if you have this like slightly dangerous, you know, shark fishing job. I've definitely come across that in certain communities. Yeah. And one of the interesting things that I've found in Aceh, one of the communities where I've done a lot of my work, is that when fishers catch certain species, or actually when fishers kind of catch any fish, they also believe that it's like a gift from God. So they often use this term rejeki, which means gift, but it also has religious connotations in terms of being a gift from God. And if, for instance, you ask fishers to release certain species because they're endangered, often fishers say, you know, not only is it a waste of money from their perspective, like, you know, we can't do that because then we can't bring it home to eat it and sell it. And it's, you know, we're literally throwing money away. They also use terms like mubazir, which in Indonesia means it means wasteful, but it also has religious connotations in that God will be displeased. So God has given us a gift from the ocean. He's given us Bezheki. And if we throw it back into the ocean after this gift has been given to us, then it's kind of insulting.
Yeah.
So you have this sort of complex interplay between different economic, social, and cultural values that essentially we need to try and disentangle and address if conservation is going to be effective.
Sure, that's really interesting. So it seems to them as if it's kind of disrespectful to refuse that gift in a way.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, that's super interesting. You know, obviously, there are social and cultural aspects as well that are kind of all tangled in with the economics, which makes things very complex. But talking about all of that kind of stuff brings us on really nicely to your project with the Save Our Seas Foundation, which is addressing that more kind of economic side and examining the role of incentives in enabling local shark conservations. In particular, you know, how Indonesia's really thriving tourism industry can contribute to this. Can you tell us a little bit more about this project?
Yes, I would love to. So I guess, as I said earlier, sort of, you know, the first step for me was trying to sort of, you know, diagnose what are these underlying social and economic issues, and then trying to figure out how we might address them. And so through various pieces of research that I conducted throughout my PhD, together with the fishers, we kind of came to the agreement that fishers would be happy to reduce their catches of critically endangered species, so hammerhead shark and wedgefish, provided they were compensated for the money they could have otherwise sold them for, which I think is fair enough. And so we decided to give it a go. And part of my research was also based on trying to actually understand what the value of these species were to the fishers, so that we could offer some kind of, you know, what would be a fair amount of compensation. And then we essentially held a workshop where we communicated all the results of the research back to the fishers. We said to them, you know, you guys said that if we compensated you, you'd be willing to participate in conservation. So let's give it a go. And the project offers fishers financial compensation if they release hammerhead sharks and wedgefish. And the way it works is that we give them a waterproof camera that is specifically provided by the project. And they have to take a video of the shark, the hammerhead shark or wedgefish being safely released. And if they submit the video to us and we see that the shark is happy and alive and swimming away from the boat, then we give them a small payment, which is equivalent to the market value of the hammerhead shark or wedgefish. And that is typically up to a maximum of around $5 per individual, because they're typically only catching relatively small hammerheads and wedgefish, which have quite low market value. But I mean, that's the main premise of the project. Oh, and then I guess to answer your other question about sort of then linking that back up to the tourism markets. So I guess the other interesting thing, which I didn't really touch on earlier, you know, when we're talking about this issue of social justice in conservation, I mentioned industrial fisheries and sort of commercial seafood companies. So on the one hand, we have those large companies that potentially create damage to marine biodiversity through their fishing activities, and they typically don't contribute to the cost of conservation. On the other hand, you have the marine tourism industry, which benefits from healthy shark and whale populations. And there are many, many tourists that come to Indonesia every year because they want to go scuba diving with sharks and rays. And the tourists and the tourism companies want healthy populations of sharks and rays. And it's often said, you know, sharks are worth more alive than they are dead because of the tourism industry. And that might be true on a kind of total macroeconomic scale if you add all the numbers up. But the people who benefit from the tourism industry and the people who benefit from shark and ray fishing, or who feel the costs of shark and ray conservation, are not the same people. And so my idea was to try to figure out some kind of mechanism for us to sort of redistribute the costs and benefits of conservation between marine tourism companies and marine tourists and small-scale fishers. So another part of my research was looking at marine tourists' willingness to pay towards community-based shark conservation. So do tourists and tour operators who come to Indonesia feel like it is their responsibility to contribute towards marine conservation? And if so, how much would they be willing to put towards a sort of a centralized pot that would then be spent on shark and marine conservation activities. And we found that in general, people do feel like it's their responsibility and that they want to do something about it. We found that on average, most tourists are willing to pay around $10 per person per day of marine tourism activities. If you kind of add all of that up in any given location, it can typically raise, you know, huge amounts of money for marine conservation. And so we looked specifically at a couple of different places as part of this project. So one of the fisheries that I'm working in Aceh, it's not very close to any tourism destinations. And often people are like, oh, can't the fishers just do tourism? But there aren't really tourists that go to that place to begin with. You know, there's no market for the fishers to just move into the tourism industry, regardless of all of the other barriers, like, you know, they can't really speak English and there's no infrastructure and they don't want to work in the tourism industry. They want to be fishers. But there is an island also in Aceh, just a couple of hours away, where tourists often go scuba diving. And it's a beautiful place. People go there to dive with sharks and rays. And so I wanted to understand whether tourists specifically who went to Pulau Wei would be willing to put money into a community-based conservation pot where that money could then be used to fund the compensate release scheme in the small-scale fishery in the long run. And essentially we found that based on sort of estimated costs of running the compensate release scheme in the small-scale fishery versus the estimated revenue that could be raised from the annual number of tourists that go scuba diving in Pulau Wei, you could end up with huge amounts of money from the tourism industry that could easily be used to fund community-based shark conservation in the long run. So that's kind of our sustainable funding mechanism for the project.
Amazing. Yeah, because that, I mean, there's a couple of things that I want to pick up on there. But the, you know, the first one is that obviously we need money for everything. So a lot of the time, you know, we'll give recommendations that we need payments for ecosystem services. We need to, you know, make sure that the benefits are also getting to the fishers as well, to sort of enable them to engage in sort of pro-conservation behaviors. And like you said, quite a lot of the time, or, you know, I don't want to make this very generic because obviously every situation is different, but I've read a lot of papers where that has been the problem, in that you have a thriving tourism industry, but none of that revenue or none of those benefits is actually getting to the fishers on the ground. But obviously, all of this kind of stuff requires money and, you know, often a long-term funding pot as well. So it's really interesting to hear kind of how you're developing that more kind of circular process. So it's almost like self-sustaining in a way. You don't have to keep looking for funding pots, you know, outside of that. So that's really, really interesting. But I guess kind of like another question that I had is, are the fishers quite open to this idea? Or are they, you know, has it been, I hate to use the word effective, but, you know, has it been quite successful in that way?
Great question. So I guess one of the other things to add is that we actually set up the project as a randomized control trial. So we essentially split the fishers into two groups. And we have what we call a treatment group and a control group, which allows us to really robustly monitor the effectiveness of the program. We make sure that all fishers have the opportunity to participate. So one group is the treatment group for 3 months, and then they switch over. So that the control group can then be in the treatment group and the previous group becomes the control group. And that just means that we give everybody the opportunity to participate, but only half of the fishers at any one time are actually allowed to receive the payment. And this means that it gives us a really robust way to measure the effectiveness of the program. Mm-hmm. And we're actually finishing up the data analysis, and we're writing a paper on that soon.
Ooh, that's exciting.
There's a couple of interesting things. We actually trialed the pay to release scheme in two different places. One, I've spoken a lot about Aceh, one in Aceh Jaya in Aceh, and one in East Lombok. The reason I've spoken mostly about Aceh is because that's where it's been most effective, and it's been much less effective in East Lombok. Despite the fact that all of our kind of pre-trial research, the fishers were like, yeah, we'll do this. And then in reality, what actually happened was different. And actually, I think, you know, that's why also setting it up as a kind of randomized controlled trial to pilot the scheme has been really useful, because regardless of what people say, how they actually behave in the real world can often be very different, because you haven't necessarily been able to take into account all of the other complicated things that might actually happen. But in Aceh, it's been super successful. We've had close to 1,000 wedgefish and hammerheads released safely in the past 18 months.
Oh, that's amazing.
And yeah, so it's been variable. You know, not all vessels have participated, and interestingly, some vessels have participated too well. And this was one of the things that was highlighted as a potential risk, and one of the reasons why it's been interesting to do it as a randomized controlled trial is we found that a couple of vessels, not all of them, seem to have kind of specialized knowledge about places they can go where they can catch more hammerheads and wedgefish in order to get the payment. And so this has been one of the interesting findings from our study. But because we set it up as a randomized controlled trial, we were able to detect this. And we've now put some new rules in place to try to protect against it. So we've slightly changed the pricing system without going into too much detail. We've slightly changed the pricing system. And we put a cap on the number of live releases that any one vessel is allowed to report and get paid for in any given week, so that we can kind of guard against the fishers going out and specifically catching more sharks and rays so they can get the compensation. So it's overall been, you know, an incredibly interesting learning process. There are a couple of other things as well I should add that we kind of built into the program. Going back to, you know, we talked about kind of social, cultural, and economic drivers. And obviously the compensates release scheme, the compensation only focuses on these economic barriers. But it was kind of a part of an integrated approach where we also had these various kind of community events. We've been working really closely with the local government, who have been fantastic and incredibly supportive and couldn't have done any of this without them. And also the customary management institutions within Aceh called the Pangalima Laut. So it's like a basically a customary institution that's to do with kind of organizing the fishers and leading the fishers. And so through engaging with the Pangalima Laut, it's also helped to kind of build the social value of the project. And we've also, you know, we've been giving out T-shirts and we've been promoting the fishers who release sharks on Instagram. And so there are kind of various other angles where we're also trying to boost the social value of shark conservation as well.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. It's all so incredibly fascinating. And it's really cool to see how a project like this actually works on a practical sense and actually kind of watch you monitor the effectiveness of this in real time. Because quite often we'll kind of write a paper about it, about why, you know, people maybe aren't engaged in shark conservation or the barriers to that, and then kind of like move on to the next thing. Whereas you've got a really sort of long-term body of work there that you're kind of continuously working on. It's really, really, really cool to see. And, you know, like you said, with the social and cultural aspect, that sort of really hits home how important it is that, you know, process matters. So not just kind of the outcome of this, but also how you do it and how people are involved in that.
And probably on that, you know, two key things to emphasize is we're, as well as monitoring what happens in terms of number of sharks released and number of sharks landed at the landing site. So that's, you know, our other measure of effectiveness is actually how many sharks and rays are killed, with the idea of trying to minimize that as much as possible. We also conduct interviews with fishers and their families about their perceived well-being and also about their kind of general attitudes and perceptions to the program. Because one of the things that we were trying to figure out is, you know, can we deliver shark conservation outcomes whilst maintaining or improving human well-being? So we wanted to also get these measures of well-being as well. And one of the interesting findings has been that when we ask fishers about their perceptions of the program, in general, everybody has got either like neutral or positive perceptions. But even the fishers that have not received a payment, even the ones that have not participated or they haven't submitted a video, still reported positive perceptions. And what people are typically saying is that they appreciate that they were consulted in the process. And they say things like they don't feel any pressure from the program. So because it's basically kind of voluntary, you know, you're given the camera, you're not expected to incur any costs as a result of participating. Generally, people are like, yeah, this is great, because people actually asked us what we wanted and we don't feel like we're having our livelihood squeezed or having our rights taken away from us. And so I think that's just been, a really important kind of anecdotal finding of the research as well.
That's so important. So, so important. You can't underestimate the value of building that kind of trust in your team, as your research team and the project, having positive interactions with people and giving, building that sort of those relationships and maintaining them and making them sustainable. That's wonderful to hear. And it just reflects how much work you and your team have done over the last couple of years to do that. You know, it takes a long time. You know, working with people can be hugely rewarding, but it can also be very challenging. I mean, we didn't get to quite touch on Lombok, where, you know, things, the effectiveness hasn't been, or it's not quite a similar case study. But it can be, you know, very, very challenging as much as it is rewarding at the same time. And I just wondered, you know, what are some of the most kind of important lessons that you've learned during your time in the field, you know, working with people?
Two immediately spring to mind. One, and this is something that I always tell anybody who comes to me asking for advice about how to do kind of conservation social sciences, or, you know, they want help designing a survey, is to always try to put yourself in the other person's shoes and always try to understand somebody else's perspective without judgment. So I think if we want to do social sciences that is effective for conservation, we should start from the standing point of genuinely trying to understand somebody else's life and perspective, and kind of turning up and starting your engagement and your interviews with, you know, hi, I'm here to understand more about your life, rather than hi, I'm here to save the sharks. Because you're just going to, A, it's not going to be good for building relationships with people in the beginning. And B, you kind of start from, I think, too much of a closed-minded point of view. And actually, if you kind of try to understand things from other people's perspective, often you'd be like, yeah, if I lived in this village, I'd probably be catching sharks too. Even though based on my life, I'm now a shark conservationist, you can then understand the circumstances and situations that lead people to behave the way they do. And then you can more readily start to think outside the box for solutions that might be suited to that particular context, rather than just kind of rolling out. I mean, often people like to think there's just like a one simple solution, you know, let's just ban shark fishing. But often, for many reasons, that it's not effective. And so, yeah, I would say starting with an open mind and genuinely trying to put yourself in other people's shoes and understand their lives. Secondly, I couldn't have achieved any of this without just the most incredible team of local collaborators. They've all just been absolutely fantastic. And I think, you know, as well as building the relationships with the communities in which we work, it's also about building capacity, for me anyway, building capacity of Indonesian researchers, working closely with Indonesian universities and the Indonesian government. And, you know, we've got people who are sort of from the communities in which we work, who are have been employed under the project, kind of collecting data and acting as our main points of contact. And then I've also got kind of an incredible team of research assistants and students who help me to conduct the research and help me, you know, my Bahasa Indonesia is pretty good now after being here for 8 years, but it's definitely not fluent and I still make mistakes. And, you know, they help me to make sure that, you know, all my writing and presentations are correct. And when we have confusion, they help me to figure it out. And And also Indonesia has lots of different local dialects. So in some instances, if we're communicating with fishers, we really need to have people who are not only bilingual, but like multilingual. They speak the local language, they speak Indonesian, they speak English. So, you know, having really good local collaborators and I guess like in mutual exchange as well, where like to some degree you're building capacity. This is obviously specific to being a kind of a foreign researcher, I guess, but where you're building capacity and they're also building your capacity because they're teaching you about how things really work and local culture and local language. Yeah. And it's been both, I think, one of the most important factors of success, but also one of the most rewarding parts of my whole time in Indonesia.
Yeah, a real team effort. A real team effort. Oh, that's so exactly. That's so lovely. And that's a really lovely place to sort of end the podcast on. And it has been so fantastic to talk to you all about your work. I mean, I could honestly talk to you all day. There are so many things that I would love to ask you, but I'm not going to keep you much longer. But a lot of the stuff that we've talked about here has been, you know, very profound, very deep. You know, we're talking about working with people, understanding the social side of things and cultures. And I'm going to ruin it now by asking you our final question of the podcast, which is a completely silly question, but it is one of my favorites. And it is, if you could be any species of shark, ray or skate in the world, who would you be and why? And a caveat, this is in an ideal world where anthropogenic pressures don't exist.
Wait, so I lost you just one second. If I had to be one species, so not my favorite species, but if I had to be one species.
If you had to be one, which one would you be?
oh my god,
I think this is harder than the first
so,
one.
the thing is, part of me, I'm gonna do a bit of a cop out and give two answers. Part of me wants to say Wobegon because they're just, for me, the cutest shark, and they're just, you know, they've got their funny little beard and they're kind of cool and they cruise around and they're like, they're, I don't know, they're giving kind of like slightly chill hippie vibes. However,
they are. They are. I've never thought about it that way.
I do think manta rays have more fun just because they're very social. So, you know, manta rays, they're like hanging out in their groups. They seem to be like swimming around, flipping around, having a lot of fun most of the time. Everybody loves them. I think based on what I understand about the latest science, they're also like pretty smart and have pretty good cognitive capabilities. Uh-huh. I think a manta ray is more intelligent than a wobegong. So I think it would probably on balance be pretty fun to be a manta ray.
Yeah, although it would be pretty fun sometimes to also be a wobegong, just to, you know, experience that sort of, on those days when, you know, you just want to be by yourself and hang out on the sea.
Exactly. You know? I feel like it kind of resonates with me to some degree as like, I'd like to be able to do both. I like to give my energy to social situations, but then I'd like to go and be a chiller wobegong sometimes. So
Yeah, I'll allow it. You could be both. Yeah. But anyway, Holly, thank you so much for all of your time. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And yeah, I hope that we'll get to kind of catch up again soon.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, likewise, a pleasure to chat. And looking forward to hearing the finished product when it's ready as well.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Save Our Seas Foundation. It was hosted and edited by me, Isla Hodgson. Our amazing visuals are by Jamie Silva. Our lovely logo is by Nicola Poulos. And the wonderful jingle you can hear right now is by David Knight. A huge thank you to Holly for coming onto the podcast and talking all about her amazing work. As always, if you would like to follow along with Holly's work or follow her on social media, we will leave links to all of her social media tags and websites in the show notes of this episode. You can find them over at www.saveourseas.com/worldofsharks/podcast, or they will also be in the description of this episode, so please do go and check them out. And thank you at home for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, review and subscribe. It really does help the podcast out. And if you would like to get in touch, you want us to answer a question on the podcast, cover a certain topic, or you just want to say hi, please feel free to do that. You can email us over at isla@saveourseas.com, or you can follow us on social media. We are at Save Our Seas Foundation on Instagram and at Save Our Seas on Twitter. Alrighty, have a awesome week, and we will see you next time.